Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And we are celebrating, this is kind of cool, the 25th anniversary of the Santa Barbara Studio Artist Tour. And to do so, I have three artists that are with me today to talk about the tour. And first of all, I want to just mention, if you're you got your calendars close by, what you want to do is mark down for the 2026 25th anniversary Santa Barbara Studio Tour. It's Labor Day weekend, and that's going to be September 5th through the 7th, 11 to 5 p.m. It's the largest studio tour on the Central Coast, and I want to mention a very fun reception is going to take place at CAW CAW, and that's going to be Friday the 4th of September from 5 to 8 p.m. on 613 Garden Street here in Santa Barbara. And if you want to find out more, you can actually look at the website Santa Barbara Studio Artists.com, and you'll see all the fun things. You'll also see how to get a hold of a map, how to get a hold of where you want to tour. And let's just see. Danuta, can you tell me how many artists are on the tour?
This year is 24 artists. Actually, 23. Unfortunately, we have a cancellation last moment. But it's 24 artists. It's a really big and fun group with a variety of different mediums and everything else.
Okay, so let me just introduce our artists here today. First of all, I have Leslie Ecker, who it was, I tell you, this has got to be the funniest thing in the world. Here's this gentleman, and we'll talk about his bio in a minute, and he's not sure he's an artist. Well, I'm sure he's an artist. Let's put it that way. And he says, okay, this is his second year, I think, Leslie?
It is.
Okay. And Leslie is a freelance creative director, designer, and visual effects supervisor of films and commercials and television programming and special projects. He's 35 years of experience on some of the most significant and award-winning feature films, commercials, and special venues projects. And I got to say, some of the credits are just amazing. He started in 1979, graduated from Art Center College of Design. He was hired on the film Star Trek, the motion picture, as a designer and visual effects animator. He began model making on my favorite movie, which is Blade Runner. And he was a model shop crew chief and special effects tech from 1982 to 1994. And then he was promoted to visual effects supervisor and creative director in 1997 in the commercial division. And he supervised and directed commercials at Digital Domain for 10 years. He's also been involved with the following. Richard, this is going to curl your hair if you had any. He's been involved in True Lies, Apollo 13, Titanic, Blade Runner, Ghostbusters, 2010, Die Hard, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Star Trek, The Motion Picture, Close Encounters Special Edition, the feature film work, for example, Evolution, and sequence in the movie Adaptation. He's recently supervised Mockingbird Lane, directed by Bryan Singer, and supervised the visual effects for pilot episode of State of Affairs by NBC Universal. He's worked for director John Woo. He supervised the shooting of two epic historical drama entitled The Crossing in China for 6 months. He recently supervised VFX for the first three episodes and established methodologies for a WeTV series called South of Hell. He's worked on 140 commercials, a dozen special venue project, and was a TEDx presenter. He was nominated for his work on Apollo 13 for an Academy Award in visual effects, and he won the British Academy Award for visual effects, as well as the Engineers Council for Distinguished Engineering Project Award. And that's just the first page of a three-page resume. I could go on, but it's pretty fantastic. And so I want to welcome Leslie to the program. And Leslie, you know, when you have your studio open, I always ask, you know, every year I try to interview a number of artists, how do you prepare what you're going to show? I mean, you've got such, are you going to show your past work, your present work? I mean, where are you landing on this?
Well, really, it comes down to the question of being an artist or not.
Oh, but I think I've established, I think people have established here.
Well, that, you know, granted, that's true. But, you know, I've always considered it just a rumor and an assumption, because I'm truly. So I'm a master craftsman. I can work in all materials. But for the art side of my expression, this is a rather novel exploit for me, because in the past, it has always been a design exploit, not an artist exploit. Now I can make things that aren't on anyone's schedule and whatever I feel and want to make. And my current work is kind of a result of an epiphany I had a couple of years ago, where I was doing something with my usual level of precision and care, and I realized it's not that much fun anymore. And so I decided to try something where I was not in control, and I just let the material speak for itself and get out of the way and see what happens. And so I'm not sure why, but I started sculpting wood with fire. And that's a very out of control kind of thing to do. But the results were so satisfying and I think rather unique. I've been focusing on that for a while. And you can see on my website, but, you know, things like this where we have.
I did see that.
A shape. Yeah, this one is one my wife just wanted to keep. So it's still around. But, you know, they are pieces that really are very impressionistic in terms of. You know, they're not a thing, but because I'm a designer, I can't help myself, and they still have utility. You can put your jewelry in it at night or serve olives to your guests. They're food safe. A lot of the things I make are things of utility and a piece of art combined. And the reason I do this is because I want people to have art that integrates into their lives. You know, paintings are wonderful. I mean, like that. But after a while, they can become invisible in your life. But if you have something you can use in a daily or more frequent basis, they reintegrate into your life each time you have an encounter with them. So that's the reason I like making things with utility. So that is last year's thing, and I've done more of that. But I'm also doing a new thing now, where I have pieces of burl wood, which has washed ashore after our fires, usually manzanita, and I've been carving into them and adding gemstones or fossils or little magical discoveries to make on these pieces. And you can tell this sort of has a bowl-like character to it, but this is one example of about 9 or 10 that I have I'll be showing and selling as well. So it's kind of an expansion of that firewood thing. So that's
okay.
What I'm doing.
I have to ask you, I noticed, I was looking at your website, I was looking at your gorgeous dwelling place. Mm. I was looking at your wife's wonderful work, too.
Yeah, she's.
And I was thinking, okay, you know, here's the gentleman we mentioned. You worked with director John Woo, and you were in China and working with him. Now, you've mentioned some really elements here that I have to question you about. So you're sculpting wood. That's one of the five elements, right? In Chinese, I guess, alchemy. But yeah. You're sculpting with wood, and you're sculpting fire. You're with fire as your medium, wood. Mm-hmm. Now you're collecting wood, which was from the water, and you're sculpting wood with fire.
And including stone as well.
And including stone. Right, with the gemstones. And that was, I mean, you've covered those. But, oh, that's earth, right? So the stones are earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is that part of your thematic idea?
No, not consciously. But what is part of my sort of quiver of technique that I draw from are some Japanese traditions. I have a strong affinity for Japanese culture, traditional Japanese culture. And among them, there are two cultures or two practices that I've long adhered to and practiced, which are Shoshugiban, which is the preservation of wood with fire. When you char lumber and then just oil it to seal it, it becomes permanent. The oldest wood structures in the world are built in this manner. And so I like the effect that fire has on wood, and I think it's also beautiful. So I've built many things with that technique, among them the fence and gates in the backyard in our Japanese garden. That was my COVID project. And then the other tradition I refer to is called Kintsugi. Kintsugi is the tradition of repairing something that's broken and highlighting the repair with gold to celebrate its new life, its re-emergence into usefulness. And what I love about that tradition is that it celebrates the fact that things can become more precious because they were broken. And I think that's a really beautiful philosophy.
So this is a great metaphor.
It is. It's really lovely. And so this was a knot in the wood, which was, you know, frankly, kind of ugly. So I knocked it out of there and filled it with resin and rimmed it in 24 karat gold leaf. And, you know, it's a celebration of things which might be considered a defect. So those are the two Asian traditions that I do incorporate into my work. I'm not so conscious of the elemental sort of panoply that you mentioned, but it is interesting to see it from that perspective. So thanks for that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the concept of things being broken and highlighting wabi-sabi, that technique of, you know, celebrating the brokenness. And there's actually that wonderful porcelain tradition in Japanese heritage where, you know, a broken thing of porcelain is put back together and then it's worth more.
Yeah. And the wabi-sabi thing, it's related to that. It's not actually in the same sort of approach, but the Venn diagrams do overlap.
Got it. Okay. And so I guess the question is, so you will be showing some of the wood that's actually been burnt and actually retrieved from the water. You'll be showing that.
I also made this 7-piece explainer. It's a 7 of the same shape, and it's the raw wood, the sculpted wood, the charred wood, the brushed wood, that's the char brushed away, and then the sealed and embellished wood. So it explains visually and you know, dimensionally what the process is for visitors. So it's really easy to understand how we arrived here.
Okay. And so are you ever tempted to make anything that it has no use?
I have, actually. I kind of chide my defaults back to the usefulness thing. And so, yes, there are several of these other more modern pieces that I've done, more recent pieces that I've done, that really don't have any use other than just an ornament. And they're often interactive, where you can display them in various different angles and positions, and they look quite different. And they're rewarding to touch as well. The stuff just feels amazing when you're finished really polishing it out.
Fantastic.
You mentioned our house also, and this is kind of an attraction for people as well. In 2015, we bought this property. It's an acre and a half. It's at the end of a little cul-de-sac on a silly little street on the west side. And we basically scraped it clean and built a house of the future. So our house was built 2 hours north of Seattle. It's a modular prefabricated home and brought in 7 enormous pieces via tractor-trailer trucks, and then installed on the foundation and bolted together and finished on site. And it is a very futuristic way of building, and it's a house that's designed to be a house that's ready for what we know is coming.
May I ask, it's here, though, isn't it?
Yes, it's on the west side.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was built in Seattle, but it was moved here.
Yes, in 7 giant pieces, the biggest thing you can put down a highway, with big escort vehicles and the wide load truck, you know, giant pieces, 47,000 pounds being the heaviest one.
Just wondering, why was the architect that you favored in Seattle, is that why it was put together there?
Well, in part, yes, because the thing that attracted my wife and I to this company is their architecture. Everything they built, we just loved. It's sort of a contemporary, modern, but not cold kind of an approach. Very humanistic, very simple. And they are also one of the highest quality modular builders and one of the original modular builders. They're connected with the Dwell organization. You might know them well on design and their magazine, Dwell. So that was just right up our alley. So that's why we chose them. And believe it or not, even though it's 1,000 miles away, it's cheaper to build it this way. It's faster and it's more solid and more earthquake resistant.
That's amazing. I just have to tell you, I looked at pictures of the house, and that I think is one of the drawing points for the art tours, by the way, is that surroundings of these artists. You have an opportunity to see how a really creative soul, you know, builds the dwelling place, the habitation, you know, the studio, the home, etc. And that to me is the, I mean, that for a person that is like me, I love, I love interior, I love exterior, you know, I just am so interested in architecture in general. And it's so interesting to see where the artist feel comfortable. That's such a, you know, it's like the cocoon around the artist. And I think that's one of the great things about the tours is you get to see how these artists really flourish in their environments.
Yeah, it's true. And my wife, Diane, and I are both designers, and we have very parallel preferences. And we really did make this as an expression of who we are and how we want to live. And so our hope is to inspire people to make better choices in the future for sustainability, because it also is an easier way to live. Twice the state of California Green Building Commission invited me to give presentations in Ventura of what we did here, because I had a whole documentary I put together about it, to give presentations to people who lost their homes in our fires.
Yeah.
The reason being that it's a great way to rebuild. It's half the time, because your house is being built at the same time your foundation is being built. So it's you overlap those schedules, which would be impossible normally. And then installation is very brief. And about less than 8 weeks after installation, you move in. And it can be 60% of the cost of normal construction. And it's much more sustainable, less waste, more energy conservative, stronger for earthquakes, number of advantages. So I did that twice. And a few people, I think, did follow up on that invitation and built that way or rebuilt that way.
See, that's another advantage to the studio tours. And I just have to say, Leslie, you were talking about design and art and where the two meet and where the two diverge, for example. And I came across, and you were saying you're so tempted to make art that is actually functional. And so I was thinking of a quote by Friedrich Nietzsche, and I have to say to you, he said, of course, this is a while back, we have art in order not to die from the truth.
Mm. Nice.
And so, you know, that's, I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about the, you know, the usages of decor versus art, et cetera. I think they're the same. So that was when you said, you know, I'm Elizabeth, I'm, you know, if you want me on the interview, I'd love to, but, you know, I don't know if I can call myself an artist. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's those ideas that an artist is, you know, a two or three dimensional person that makes things that go in a white box and they get displayed with a card and certain types of lights. That's maybe, you know, that's something that we've outgrown a little bit, you know.
True. Yeah. And, you know, there's a strong overlap, of course, between design and art. And I've always been artistic and I can draw and paint and all those things. I think for me, the distinction is the pieces I make also have utility, whereas a lot of art doesn't have, strictly speaking, a utility other than to inspire and evoke and you know, impress and create love and connection and energy. So I explore the intersection between those two realms, the tool and the instrument or the music.
Right. Okay. Got it. Well, I want to come back to you. I've got
No,
a bunch of questions.
I feel bad because nobody else had any opportunity to talk.
Oh, no, but we're, you know, life is long. So we have to go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I want to introduce Danuta to the conversation. Also, my artist, Leslie, Sarita. Okay, Rich, let's go to quick break. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. Great pleasure to interview three of the artists that are on the Santa Barbara Studio Tours this year. This is the 25th anniversary 2026 Santa Barbara Studio Tour, Labor Day weekend, September 5th through the 7th. Largest on the Central Coast, for example, we've got 24 artists or 23 artists. And we're going to talk a little bit to Sarita. And Sarita, first of all, I was very impressed with what your statement was. That I asked you to send me a quick bio, quick idea, artist statement, and I was thrilled to read that you talk about the play between time, texture, and memory. I think that's so evocative because, you know, makes me think, does time have a texture? And of course it does. I mean, when I think about periods in my life, I think about, oh, that was a rough patch or that was a smooth patch. Or, you know, there's this idea of time having a texture. And then I want to talk to you about that. You are a contemporary painter and you are working in, I don't know, plaster and house paint. I don't want to say abstract work, but there's this same idea, you know, what Leslie was talking about with the ideas building up, you know, the construction end of things versus the taking away end of things. So you wisely say, you know, you've got a duplicity of construction versus erosion. And that part of what you do is, am I getting this right? But part of what you do is actually to leach and scrape away what you're working to build. And in that, you know, there's a commonality with what Leslie's telling us about that perfect is not always the done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I consider, well, first of all, thank you for having me. I really appreciate this, Elizabeth. Yes, I refer to myself as a deconstructivist painter. And basically, I so appreciate your perspective on this, and you're right on the money. Yes, I build up surfaces. So I start by a painted surface. I apply layers of plaster covering the entire painting. So as I'm painting the initial base layer, I'm fully invested in it, knowing all the while it will all be covered and you will see none of it. After which I claw, I scrape, and I just work at that surface. So I expose small little bits and nuances of that former life that the painting has. And so along with that, which again plays into what Leslie was saying, and there's sort of beauty in the scars of things. And so my work is not precious. It isn't delicate. There is a very raw textural quality to it. You can almost see when you look at it, the work that's been done to it. And in a nutshell, this is all part of a larger concept. And the story behind it is my husband and I were traveling through Nepal and Bhutan a few years ago, and we met some locals, and they knew I was an artist, and we engaged in this lovely conversation about what it means to be an artist. And they just flat out said they really didn't believe so much in this concept of artists. And of course, you know, I didn't know what quite to make of that. And then taking it further, they explained that all the beauty in the world already exists, essentially from a higher power. And as artists, it's our job to expose and introduce that beauty that already existed in the world. And immediately a light bulb went off in my brain, and I said, there's something here. I absolutely adore this idea of exposing, introducing the beauty that already existed. And so that set the template for all of my paintings.
Okay, so a question for you. You say that, you know, you prepare the surface, mm-hmm. knowing full well that it is going to go away.
Yes.
But, you know, there's this idea. Okay, so I have to bring you back. Okay, the 16th and 17th century, this idea of pedimento. So the idea is that, you know, no matter what the bottom surface is, that pedimento actually shows through, whether it's subconsciously, mm-hmm. microscopically. You know, now we have the instruments that will actually show us that pedimento. And it's part of a work, that yep. underlying surface. Insofar as, you know, this fun thing about being or having my job, you know, as an appraiser, the first thing I do when I'm addressing a canvas, an older canvas, for example, that hasn't been relined, I'm flipping it and I'm looking at the back to see where the oils that are more highly saturated, mm-hmm. you know, your ceruleans and this sort of thing, how they're bleeding through, and if I can see that pedimento. So I'm looking underneath before I look on top, you know, and that's what was so interesting to me about, you know, what you're doing. The second question I have for you is this idea where you're using very active verbs just now to tell me these things, clawing, scraping, you know, and you were using your hands that mm-hmm. way. You're using, and you said tactile. You were some of the words I was writing down, some of the rawness. You see, all these are like very active verbs, active yeah. adjectives, for example. So the physicality of this?
Oh, is a huge part okay. of what I do. It's very interesting because the process is such a huge part, and I get more questions about the process than anything. You are absolutely right. It is an extraordinarily physical process. I am, just as you said, clawing, scraping, deconstructing. I use so many tools, everything from things in the hardware to things you'll find under your kitchen sink. And it's been an absolute joy to explore all of the different qualities and markings I can create with these different tools, which is why I say the art itself tells you just the kind of work that's being put into it. This is not a precious, delicate piece at the end. And I would say, above all else, if what I hope that people get out of it, simply put, is rather than ask yourself, well, what is this a painting of? I'm more interested in the idea of someone looking at it and asking themselves, what was this? What was this? That there was a history, a legacy that is there, and it's just being hinted at. You see shadows and suggestions of it. But what's lovely about that is, my hope is that rather than just look at it, visually take it in and digest it and process it and move on, this is a situation where the more you look at it, the more you see, the more it suggests. And that's what makes it a very vital, living piece of art.
So, okay, you make me think of a couple of things. And Richard's giving us a sign we got to go to quick break, which we will. There's a theory, it goes back, you know, Roman times. And it's called ipsiloquitur, so it's the object speaks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's used also in legal terminology. So it's evident by the object. The object itself speaks. There's no way that the object can stand without speaking. So that's one thing that, you know, what you're describing makes me think of. And then this idea that all beauty exists to be exposed. That's another really interesting thought insofar as the basis of all things is beauty. And that is, you know, that's it, it sort of begs the question, if all beauty exists to be exposed, then therefore the beauty must lie inside or underneath all things. It follows, you know, logically follows. So the idea is, do you ever find that you found when you're scraping, clawing, actively pulling, do you ever find, wow, this is just like this surprise I did not expect? And in fact, I don't really think it's beautiful. I'm thinking it's a surprise that I'm not welcoming, for example. Or is it the other way around? What you're finding is in fact such an essence that it doesn't actually occur to you to think about, is this beautiful or not beautiful? Well, idea is which of it is it, Sarita? Mm-hmm. Are you finding mistakes that are, you know, not mm-hmm. not necessarily cosmic accidents, but
right? This is a fantastic question, and it taking it a step further, you know, I guess the question could be, when do you know it's done? Because we've started the process. There's glimmers of, oh, this is gorgeous. This was unexpected. Oh, I love the way that the plaster's come off just so, and it's left this sort of textured, very, very light surface, and I love that. And there are times that I take it too far. The scraping is taken a little too far. The lovely thing about this, though, I will say, is working with plaster is very forgiving, because if at any point I feel I have taken it too far, what do? We basically start the process again and I cover it. It is a process of uncovering, covering, uncovering, covering. Sometimes it works out absolutely beautifully where I just sort of intuitively know how to go about it compositionally and it all just comes together beautifully. But truthfully, most of the time, it is a constant play between adding, subtracting, adding, subtracting, and ultimately knowing when to say there is balance here. There is real curiosity into what this is all about, the story, the history. And almost, as I said, more than anything, it's the art of knowing, simply put, when to walk away and let it
so itself. Okay, so you're talking about process.
Yes.
Yeah, and so this is such an important factor, the idea of process, that a work is never particularly, I mean, it's finished in the artist's eyes,
mm-hmm.
but it may not be finished as process is concerned to the viewer. Mm-hmm. And I want to mention a teacher at City College who's also a great surfer, Michael Drury. And Michael he's an oil painter. He's been teaching oils for 40, 50 years, something like this, ungodly. And I said to him, Michael, you know, you've taught thousands and thousands of young artists. What's the most difficult thing that you teach? And I don't know if you've ever worked with oil, but this will make sense when you think about working with oil. He says, what I teach is how to stop before the student paints the brown potato in the sky.
Right.
And that's what his, so the brown potato in the sky, for people who don't work with oil, is that if you work with oil and you start muddling your colors, you're going to get a brown potato instead of a cloud, mm-hmm. or a brown potato instead of a tree. You're going to get some kind of brown potato. So the idea he was teaching in that process is to stop, but then to leave enough so that the process continues with the viewer.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we have to go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I want to introduce Danuta to the conversation, but also I want my artists here, Leslie, Sarita, to be thinking of good questions to ask your fellow artists, one or two, and you can pick a couple of questions for an artist or both artists, and then I'd love to hear some questions from you. Okay, Rich, let's go to quick break. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. Great pleasure to interview three of the artists that are on the Santa Barbara Studio tours this year. This is the 25th anniversary 2026 Santa Barbara Studio Tour, Labor Day weekend, September 5th through the 7th. Largest on the Central Coast, for example, we've got 24 artists or 23 artists. Yeah. And we've got a reception at CAW CAW on 613 Garden Street Friday, 4th of September, 5 to 8. That's almost a must-do if you're going to do this tour, because you get to meet the artist. Once you meet the artist, you're going to have a whole different sense of who you want to visit. Guarantee. And usually they've got some work behind them where you kind of see a little sample of what you're going to look at and see. And I would say if you've done this tour before a number of times, challenge yourself. This is something that I'm going to do this year. I'm going to challenge myself, because I generally pick the tour, you know, I'm going to visit certain places. You can't visit, well, you can visit all 23, 24 if you're very good. But usually I pick sort of things that I think, well, they're hangable, they're usable, they're, you know, there's something that I can see around me. I'm going to challenge myself this year. I'm going to challenge myself, and I'm calling it the audacity of scale. I'm going to say go beyond the scale that you usually pick for yourself, Elizabeth. Go something different than this, because scale is starting to matter to me. I don't know why. And later in life, I'm starting to think about scale so much more. So if you've gone for the 24 by, you know, 36 or the 20 by 24, two-dimensional, challenge yourself. You know, go for the big, go for the small, go for the three-dimensional, you know, go for the built, go for the process related, you know, challenge yourself with scale and process, instead of like, okay, this would be nice to have in my, oh, of course it can be both, but that's my goal for this year. And I'm going to introduce to the conversation Danuta. And you may have realized that she is on the board, and she was coaching me to tell you that this was the 25th anniversary, for example. And she's a Polish-born American artist. She blends contemporary realism, contemporary abstraction with poetic realism. I mean, in a really interesting way, I think of Eastern European fairy tales, for example. And then she is emigrated to the United States, and she's developing a visual language, and she is using intuition and biology and symbolism. She is the co-founder of the Aolin Center for Psychotherapy and Creativity. And this is a center that offers public lectures and workshops exploring the intersection of psyche and art. She illustrated the history of psychology through symbols, written by Dr. James Broderick, and she continued the work through her teaching. Her work is at the Art and Soul Gallery in Santa Barbara and Illuminations Gallery at LCCCA in La Cumbre, for example, and she's been part of the Santa Barbara Studio Artists for 10 years. She opens her studio doors in Goleta, Santa Barbara, and Montecito, and each studio tour is different. I think this is fantastic. We have a core Jungian in our hands, introducing the history of psychology through symbolism. I love it. And she quotes this, Mike, work grows out of duality. I've lived between two different worlds, artist and scientist, Poland and the United States, structure and intuition, memory and the present moment. I live between two languages. Language describes the world differently. Over time, I became aware that language does not simply express experience. It shapes how we feel and think. Oh, total semiotics. Yes, definitely does. And so I think if we could take an example, Danuna, what was an image that you had a challenge with? And like add to that as a codicil to that question, what's an image that stayed with you in your dreams?
I think, you know, I believe that we have the shared symbolism that we all carry in our unconscious. And I think the symbolism, it's really important for me because it connects the differences and different realities that I lived with. So it's often something that it's universal. But when we think it's universal, it's not exactly the same for every culture. So we might think that, let's say, a wing or something represent, or a circle represents something that is common, but we interpret that in many different ways. So I think it's a question that is so personal in a way that it's hard to choose one image particularly.
Well, I'm asking you to discuss one. I think about, for example, in my life, I had, this is early on, I had an artist that wanted to show, and I was good at finding venues so he could have a public show at a museum, for example. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the Smithsonian. It wasn't a top flight. I was looking for smaller museums I could give this artist a show. And he was young, and he was a do-it-yourself artist. He'd come out of the world of skateboarding and designing for skateboards and surfboards, and he was a very accomplished artist. But he was leaving the design world and going into the what he called the world, the art world. And actually, he was an artist, just like we're talking to Leslie about. So, but he had a terrible experience where he was prepared. I got him the show at Escondido Art Center, and he was preparing for the show, and he couldn't stop painting horses. And he wasn't an artist that was known for horses at all. And he was painting horses, horses, horses. They were haunting him, haunting him, haunting him. And he said, you know, Elizabeth, I can't stop. I don't know what's going on. This image is on top of my head. I can't stop. And I realized, and I went to see him, and he had, you know, butcher paper over all the eaves of his studio full of horse imagery. And he was going way back into this, you know, subconscious, unconscious, and he was painting horses, you know, the horse mm-hmm. of the cortege, the horse of the funeral procession, the horse of the warrior, all these things, you know, he couldn't stop, and he didn't know where it was coming from. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, kind of haunted him, and he had to get over the imagery in a way so that he could move on from it, mm-hmm. but it took him a real a soul effort to get through that imagery. So that's why I was asking you, Danuta, if there was an image Yeah.
So I actually, yes, there is a one form, actually. It's a circle. It's a sphere that appears in my images almost. It doesn't matter if it's abstraction or if it's more realistic image. And I didn't even personally notice that before. I was kind of, you know, somebody came actually in a studio during studio tour and it's like, there are circles everywhere. And it clicked with me. And I think that conversation kind of just made me realize that there is something that drives me towards that element. And they range from a very kind of organic ones to inspired by yin and yang kind of, you know, Asian philosophies to something very almost structural, like mechanical. So it really hit me. And then during the class, when I was co-teaching at the Pacifica, one of the students mentioned something, not in relation to my art, but something else, that sometimes the circle represents a self. And it really hit me during that moment that it's like there's maybe something that I'm searching between those words that you mentioned, between the artist and scientist and Poland and United States and state and talking in different languages that express things very differently. I actually remember that when I immigrated, I didn't speak very good English at all. So my first way and my first job was actually becoming a graphic designer because I couldn't really write yet. I couldn't really talk fluently. And so showing images and presenting my ideas in form of image was the way to communicate. And that kind of stayed through the whole career that I have.
Fantastic. Okay, we've got a couple of minutes. I'm wondering, Leslie, do you have a question for any of the two artists?
Well, no, but I really appreciate, Sarita, your images to me feel like memory. They remind me of a memory I can't quite visualize. And so I really connect with that and appreciate the depth of what you do. It really comes through. So I just hope you know that it works for me exactly what you were going for. And I'm happy to hear you describe it, you know, in language, because impressions, you know, it's a self-contained thing within my circle and I can't know out of it. But now I have an opening.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. I do. And actually, I have a question for Leslie, if I may. So what I think we have, this shared sensibility, is this notion of there being beauty in perfections, in imperfections,
yeah.
Highlighting the scars. You're talking about these scars, for lack of a better way of putting it, mm-hmm. in wood and highlighting that.
Yeah.
So I guess if I had a question, it would be, as it aligns with my work, are you interested in people who see your work and are appreciating it, being curious about the story or the history behind the wood itself? In other words, it's not just enough to look at and say, well, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But how did the grooves get here? Was it in a fire? Did you find this at the side of the road and you made something beautiful of it? Was this at the bottom of a stream? Because that's how I personally respond to your work, that there is this history, a former life, and that's what makes it fascinating and really interesting.
Well, I'm really glad you picked that up because it's a big part of what I'm doing. You know, if you look at any piece of wood, and this is an excellent example, you know, that every ridge is a year. That's a growth ring, and they only happen once a year. And the hardest part of the wood is what becomes a ridge when you burn it. Softer stuff burns deeper and is brushed away, and the result in this texture. And so you are looking at the life history of the tree. Every little knot is a branch. Here's a tiny little twig that just started out, and larger knots are larger branches. And that's growth and it's change and it's evolution. And so it's very much about that. And these newer pieces are the same thing in a kind of a different way. I find these as these really ugly black lumps on our shoreline in the driftwood line. Every now and then I'll run across one. I grab it and bring it home. And they are really not appealing at all, but they have such a history to them because they're the root. The burl is the root ball of usually the manzanita tree, which is very slow growing and very hard, very dense wood. And it's evolved to thrive and reproduce with fire. It has a relationship with fire. Sometimes there's erosion after our fires, and these things get eroded out of the hillside and tumble down into a creek and rushed and dumped into the ocean, where they drift around for a while and get thrown up on the beach. Who knows how many years they've spent traveling, and then they find their way into my hands. And so I'm really respecting that and exhibiting their history inside of the black shell. Mm-hmm. Go from this sort of lunar landscape to that, you know, very rich and beautiful thing. And I think that invites people to see things differently, to see things in with the perspective of time and trauma and healing and evolution and where we end up. It's a beautiful place. So it's exactly what I'm going for, actually. So that's a very perceptive question. Thank you for that.
Well done.
Yeah. And so do we have a question for Dinuta, please?
Oh, I have an observation. I saw your work at Art and Soul the other day when I went down for the Chris Potter abstract show, which was wonderful. I'm a huge fan and friend of our long now past masterful. And I saw your work in the gallery. It was really lovely to see it. I've seen it many times around town, and I really appreciate it. And I love the circle thing you were talking to. I'm really happy to hear you talk about that, because I love that. And I'm very much into the circle as a symbol and a mathematical perfection and a manifestation of nature. Everything in the universe rotates. You know, it's a very cosmic, important thing. And I love seeing your use of it in such a lovely compositional and color aware kind of a space. So I'm just appreciating your art. It's not really a question.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I also want to mention that. So it's interesting on the studio tour, when people visiting different places, you live in a pretty new house and you know, there's anything between. My studio is located in a place that was created as an art colony in 1800s by Whitehead. So it has an incredible history of that kind of approach. And there is like an old kind of garden setting that people can wander through. And it's I think that's what we're giving to opening our doors as artists, to not just possibility of meeting us and talking to our to the artists and about our processes or what we wanted to communicate, but we also kind of showing how our vulnerable sides, we're showing how we work, we're showing our tools, we're showing how we organize or not our stuff. And I think that is actually quite beautiful, because I see people kind of lighting up just to learning how we do stuff.
True. My studio is actually a workshop. It's part of the garage. And it has a ton of machinery in it. I have every tool known to humankind. And the space is also a gallery. I have art all over the walls in my workshop to inspire me and to just appreciate and, you know, keep a presence to art. And so people do enjoy seeing that as well, even though it's not my art. And the house itself is a work of art. There's every bit of it is curated by us over our lives. We've spent 44 years together, you know, pursuing beauty and design. So it is great for people to go and see these places, because it's a lot more than just go and see how the art's made. It's more than that. And we have done the tour as participants, not as visitors for years before I started last year. And Diane and I would go to all kinds of places. We've been to your place as well. And we just loved meeting these artists. We had so many wonderful connections, and often buy art as well. Our place is a gallery. You can barely see it, but that wood trim at the top of the wall, that's actually gallery rail. I put up 240 feet of it myself when we moved in, so I can hang pictures with cable and change the art at a whim. So it's very simple to change. No holes in the wall, all that. It's great. And so, you know, when we go to people's homes, if I'm able, I will give people tours of the home. Sometimes difficult, because I might be here on my own. But that, I think, is really where the value comes, because you see the environment that is an expression of who that artist is. And that expression, I think, lends depth and soul to the piece.
Yes, and just to go on to that, and certainly let your listeners know as regarding the Open Studio Tour, agreed, seeing where people work is phenomenal, absolutely. The other thing, which is just a basic fact, is when you go to people's studios, you are going to be able to talk to the artists. And when you go to galleries, often, you know, there might be somebody there who might know a little bit. They might direct you to the person's website. But nobody can speak to the art, about the art, the way an artist can. Sure. And this is a phenomenal opportunity to see a large, broad breadth of different creative people working, but it also, it frees you to have these fabulous conversations, ask questions, and you're going to hear it right from the artist. And that in itself is phenomenal.
True. I've always thought it would be a fabulous tourist opportunity. People come up from LA or wherever who are interested in art, go to the Friday night reception, see a piece by each artist, get a map, and then have a kind of a curated, you know, micro bus tour or whatever of a number of studios. I think that would be an amazing experience of Santa Barbara culture for people who aren't from here, because it really is so much of a foundation of what this town is.
That often happens. People organize actually the vacations around the tour because it's Labor Day weekend, and we advertise from LA to San Luis Obispo. So there's a lot of people coming just for that, knowing that since it's like, you know, every year is the Labor Day weekend. So yeah, that's a good observation.
Oh, that's great.
Well, Richard's going to tell us we have to go for now, but I want to just reintroduce. I've been speaking with Leslie Ecker. I've been speaking with Dinuta. And I've been speaking with Sarita Reynolds, three of our artists on the 25th, 2026 Santa Barbara Studio Tour Labor Day weekend, and an absolute must-do. And those of us who have children between the age of 20 and 30, like I do, I'm pretty tired of minimalism, and so I'm looking forward to the tour. So then I can see environments that are not minimalist and composed of computer cords and white, black, and beige. I'm really looking forward to that. Those of you who are like me, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Thank you, all of you, Sarita, Dinuta, Leslie. Thank you for being with us. And I look forward to seeing you all on the studio tour. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thank you for having
us. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye-bye.